Hi, this is Richard Edelman, and you're listening to The Trust Makers.
Hi, I'm Justin Blake, Executive Director of the Edelman Trust Institute. I'm joined by Roy Bahat, the head of Bloomberg Beta, a venture capital firm backed by Bloomberg LP, which is focused on understanding the profound changes in the way business works. Throughout his career, Roy has held a variety of positions, ranging from consulting to co-founding businesses to government. All of them have had a through line of focusing on the future of work. I'm looking forward to unpacking the findings from our recent Trust Barometer report on trust at work with Roy. Roy, welcome to the Trustmakers.
Thank you.
So Roy, as I said in the introduction, you've worked across a variety of institutions from nonprofits to city government to media, academia, and investing. And you've said that the thread tying all of your career moves together was a desire to make work better. How did you become so interested in the future of work?
It's been fun seeing our paths intersect across some of those episodes. So I started out being interested in how people could just participate in our economy and society. I ran a small nonprofit when I was in college. I became interested in the role of philanthropy and philanthropic donors and how the media influenced them, dot, dot, dot. And from place to place where I went to work, what I realized is people were suffering from one of two things. Some people suffered from inability to get enough work or get the work they wanted. And, you know, we've all been at times in our career in places like that. When I left city government and was trying to make my way back into the media business, it took me almost a year and 100 interviews before I could figure out how to work. And it's like, I think I have something to offer here, but somehow this efficient job market does not seem to be functioning the way it is. So that's, and I was in a very privileged place because I wasn't worried about paying rent. You know, I had some like consulting projects, so let alone somebody who couldn't do that. So that's one category, is people suffering from not enough work. The other category is people suffering from work, which is to say all our colleagues who we know, particularly at the earliest stages of their career, who take jobs and are like, wow, this just seems crappy in one way or another. And so I thought work is the thing that we do with more of our waking hours than anything else. In the US, at least, it is central to our identities as individuals. You know, what do you do for a living, for better and for worse? I'm not saying that's a good thing. And it seemed to produce a lot of misery. And so my kind of high level idea when we started this venture capital firm, Bloomberg Beta, was sure seems like work ought to get better. It sure seems like technology has made our lives outside of work much better. You know, how we were shopping, how we were connecting with friends. And it only stood to reason that technology ought to also make our work lives better. So that was the idea.
So does Bloomberg Beta focus on both the not enough work part of the equation and people suffering from work, or purely the people suffering from work?
It's both. Technology is not the only tool, of course, that we can use to get at these issues. And I've spent some time in government and in civil society and academia. But I do think it's the fastest tool, and that's why I focus on it. And I mean, I was struck in the Trust Barometer report that tech is one of the most trusted industries still at, you know, I think it was 76% trust. And that to me is more evidence of the fact that in addition to going fast, that there's readiness and willingness. People broadly, despite all the risks of technology, people seem interested in having more technology in their lives so their lives are better.
Another finding of the Trust Barometer, including in the recent Trust at Work study, is people trust my employer more than they trust other institutions. Why do you think it is that people trust their own employer more than other institutions?
It's a great finding and one that I'm really curious about. My suspicion is that employers, especially in the US, have become so central to how our lives work. You know, they provide us with healthcare. They provide us often with a sense of community, of friends, of people we spend time with. They sometimes align with our identities in terms of how we want to make the world better. You know, people join a company because they believe in it. And we've seen this, you know, Bloomberg Beta, when we invest in a company, the returns go to fund Bloomberg Philanthropies. which is Mike's philanthropic foundation. And founders love that because they say, okay, we can make money and it'll help fight climate change and educate children and stop guns. And so even values have become tied to your employer. And so it's no wonder that once you've chosen or found yourself at this institution that has a, such a big impact on your life, if your life is going to work, you want to trust that institution. And so that's my sense of why it is. And it, in a way, it's both a testament to the role employers play and a warning sign, because if you're going to play that central a role in the lives of the people who work for you, with great power comes great responsibility.
Do you feel like this idea of people choosing employers because of a values match is something that has increased recently?
So first of all, there used to be this myth that people in the past used to spend a long time at a single company and now they hop around. And that's really not that true. People have always hopped around. It's just that really like a certain generation of white men tended to work at the same company for a long time. And so I think the moving around is a thing that happens. I think it's a privilege to get to choose your employer based on values alignment. You know, a lot of people have to choose based on things like commuting distance or pay or just ability to get a job somewhere. I mean, when I went to News Corp, I didn't have a ton of other offers. I mean, I'm grateful that I got to go to News Corp, but it wasn't because of values alignment. So I think that said, I do think what's changed is that many employers have made their values a more central part of their outward facing brand. And so we've seen employers who will say what they do to take on climate change, or, you know, we saw in the wake of Black Lives Matter, so many employers declaring their stance on fighting racism. And given that, I do think that the values for the people who have the ability to make the choice, the values of the employer have become a much more central thing. And, you know, some of it is like, what do you do on social and political issues? Some of it just strikes me as the very fundamental, and you know this better than I do about what creates trust, but some of it just strikes me as very fundamental, which is, do they do the things they say they're going to do? Are they consistent? Do they avoid unethical behavior? That kind of stuff does seem to me to be very important.
Have you seen major shifts in the role of the workplace, particularly coming out of COVID and return to office?
Yes. I mean, we had COVID and we have had all these societal upheavals, you know, extremists in office and threats to our democracy and, you know, conflict overseas. And so I think that the big change from my perspective is there used to be a received wisdom about, you know, work is just work. You don't bring your whole self to work. You're not there to talk about your political views. And then as employers started encouraging employees or talent, it's not always employees, contractors too, to bring their whole self to work, all of a sudden we have this terrain that is now contested over what's appropriate and what's not.
And how do you advise leadership teams at this moment on how to navigate this terrain?
There's no clear answer. I think this is a we're figuring it all out together. I do this occasional series on LinkedIn called This Is Not Advice, where we ask, it's sort of Dear Abby, but for work, where we ask people questions about how to navigate these issues. And we've asked about these social and political issues. Here's my the only thing I know for sure is that the wrong way to handle it is to think about any of these issues in isolation, which is to say, what should our stance be on climate change? The right way to handle it is to think, what is our overall approach as an employer to what stances we take and don't take? Where do we engage in the world? And, you know, stakeholder thinking is the best way to think about that, I think. What do our customers care about? What are the government entities we need to work with care about? What do our employees care about? And how responsive do we want to be? So developing, even if it's a simple framework, some holistic framework seems really essential to me. And the companies that do that will have a basis for saying, here's why we didn't take a stance on this issue. Here's why we believe our benefits package aligns with what our social beliefs are. You know, all these choices are deeply interrelated and you need a framework.
That's certainly the advice we would give on that as well. One of the other topics that you are very outspoken on and write about a lot is AI. And in fact, you, thank you very much, came to the Edelman Trust Summit that we did over the summer and had some very interesting words about AI. So I wanted to get into that topic with you. One of the themes when you write and talk about AI is about bringing the right voices into that conversation, whether that be labor unions, civil society, other voices. Why is that so essential?
We've been at the AI game for a while. So our venture firm was, as far as we know, the first VC firm to focus on investing in AI. We've been doing it since 2014. And, you know, one of the reasons it's essential to bring these voices in is because, unlike trust in technology generally, as a society, we're still figuring out how to engage with AI. I mean, I noticed that only 30% of people in the trust barometer embrace AI. That seems like a huge contrast to how many of them trust the tech industry generally. And I think the reason for that is strange things are scary, period, full stop. Even if they're great, strange things are scary, and AI is very strange. And so if we want what I want, which is an accelerated pace of technology adoption, while it has a good effect, then there's no solution but to incorporate the perspectives of those who are most affected. And sometimes that will happen through government representation and regulation, and we've had a robust debate about that. Sometimes it'll happen at the level of the individual company building things, where it has to listen to its workforce. Sometimes it'll happen through established civil society institutions like labor unions that represent people who will be affected. So you look at something like the Writers Guild strike in Hollywood, where how AI would be incorporated was such an essential issue. And they came up with a bunch of novel ideas of what to do. Ideas like, you know, who would get credit, who owned the IP, what rights did they still reserve in order to take legal action in the future, et cetera, et cetera. And so I believe in this engagement because what we need to accelerate is massive experimentation. If what we have is just a bunch of tech founders who we support them, invest in them, but if they decide single-handedly, what's going to happen is they're going to fly a jet plane into a brick wall.
Let's talk about speed of adoption, because one could possibly make an argument that greater government regulation, bringing in other voices, that could simply slow down this process. What I inferred from your prior answer is that actually doing some of those inclusion efforts and safeguard efforts early on actually speeds adoption.
It's not either or. It's all about the design of exactly how you do it and the timing and dosage. So I think if you say, well, engaging with government will slow adoption, guess what's even slower is outright bans on certain activities or government overreactions to things. So there's a timing and dosage. We spend a lot of time on AI. We also spend a lot of time with organized labor. I chair a group at the Aspen Institute that's a club for businesses that are labor open that want to engage with organized labor in a reinvented way and experiment. Because I think unless we get this question right, it's going to be hard to get America to work as a society and economy. And the evidence from plenty of other industries is if you have an effective structure for incorporating, say, the perspective of workers, you can actually speed up adoption. Doesn't guaranteed happen. You can also slow it down. We see, for example, right now there's a strike at the ports in the US, some of the ports, where they're calling for a ban on automation, which apparently may already be in their contract. And I think strikes me as not a great thing to have a ban on automation. But you got to figure out what is the right timing and dosage for it. And, you know, the last thing I'll just say is that as a CEO, which I used to be, how do you roll out new technology? You'd usually do it through, I guess I'd call it incremental guesswork. All right, we want to have this new software. Let me ask a handful of employees who kind of are sort of representative, and then I'll roll it out to a few people. I'll see how they respond. Then I'll roll it out to everybody else. It would have been awesome and arguably faster for me to get to go to a duly elected democratic representative of my workforce and say, guys, we're going to be rolling out folks. We're going to be rolling out this new CRM or bonus system. We did a new bonus system when I was a CEO. I would like you to represent the employees and let's figure out together how this should look. And then once it rolls out, if the employees grumble, I'd be like, you go talk to your own elected representative. We work this out with them. So I think there are ways that these structures, if you get in the habit of using them, can speed things up.
I've known you for a while and you've been interested in the role and importance of unions really since we've had these conversations together. I'm curious how much you've seen from the business side in terms of an evolution of willingness, non-willingness to engage labor around some of these topics?
Yeah. So first of all, I think that the idea that unions and labor are synonymous is not true. So unions are a particular kind of institution. They're an important kind of institution in America and around the world. But unions are not the only form of labor organization. So in tech, you know, we saw efforts like the Google walkout that was an ad hoc effort organized against issues around mediation for sexual harassment and other employee issues. And my attitude is that business leaders have always dealt with what their workforce wants. It's just that they don't have the muscle of having done it when workers are organized. And arguably, that is much better for them. And I think as unions have been in the news more, both because Americans' approval of unions is now at an all-time high, according to Gallup longitudinal polling, you know, as high as it's been, maybe not all time, but since the late 60s or something like that, because of high-profile campaigns at companies like Starbucks and Apple, many employers are now grappling with, well, maybe I'll have to face this. And that's causing them to think, the thing we advise them to do is to think, as if my workforce were organized, how would I engage with them? And I think that we're now seeing greater openness to experimentation and everything from things that lots of employers have, like employee resource groups, where, you know, okay, there's a group of all the employees with a certain identity affiliation, and I want to have dialogue with them, to some more aggressive experiments. One of my favorites is worker-elected board representatives. So that's not a union necessarily, but it is a labor organization. And imagine having that worker's perspective in the boardroom.
So in some ways, this could solve for one of the findings from our Trust at Work study, which is that there's a real divide between associates and executives on AI implementation. Associates are much less likely to feel control over introduction of AI into the workplace. It seems like some of these labor organizations or the types of organizations that you said businesses are creating or could be created from employees up are ways of having them feel engaged in terms of adoption of AI and other new initiatives?
Yes. And I think that word engagement, I'm gonna stop and zoom in on that word for a second, because engagement can mean so many things. It can be a euphemism for we had lots of dialogue and then you ignored me. It can mean we felt like part of the process. And if another word that frequently gets thrown around in these contexts is worker voice. And when executives talk about worker voice, what they sometimes mean is I surveyed everybody or I looked at the data of what software they used and then I decided what the right thing is to do. And I think the more important word to think about is power. To what extent as business leaders do we believe that our workforces deserve power over some of these choices? And if they do deserve power, or maybe sometimes they'll just take it whether we think they deserve it or not, what are the best ways to engage? And my view is that it's hard in the long run for people to feel good unless they have agency over what is happening to them. And that means power. And one of the reasons I think COVID in some ways was such a positive for talent, employees, associates, power, is people just out of necessity had to make a lot of their own choices. What's your home office going to look like if you're working remote? What software are you going to use? I mean, the stat I would love to see is by year, for the typical office associate, I'll use the Edelman word for it, which I think is a good one, how many new pieces of software did they use that year by year? And my guess is 2020, 2021, it shot through the roof. And that meant that a lot more people were taking power over what the tools would be that they would use.
Before we leave the topic of AI, you've written about building better AI using the metaphor of looms versus cranes. Can you go into that metaphor?
Yeah. So, you know, this is about a slightly different question around AI, which is related to what we've been talking about. The question is AI going to take away the jobs? And we can have that whole discussion. My one sentence answer is, of course it will, because technology always has. If you look back to our grandparents' generation, they'd be like, all the jobs got automated. What Justin and Roy are doing right now, talking into microphones and having fun discussing the future, that's not work. Like, nobody's going to lose a hand doing that, you know, that kind of thing. So that's my kind of take. But I think the timing is still TBD and the impact on individuals, there are better and worse ways for it to unfold. And arguably, the last time we had mass automation, it resulted in things like world wars, literally. And I'd like to have a healthier transition than that. And so then you ask the question of, okay, well, how can you have a healthy transition? Some of it depends on what government does and the social floor and all kinds of stuff, but some of it depends on what AI we build. And the case I'm making is that not all AI is created equal. Some of it is helpful, and some of it can be helpful under some circumstances and harmful. And some people talk about this in terms of automation, i.e. replacing what a person does versus augmentation, something that helps a person be better at their job. And I think we can be even more crisp than that. So in the automation world, I talk about the metaphor of a loom, like a spinning loom. A spinning loom at first is designed to help a person to weave faster, but eventually can replace them entirely. And then when we look at augmentation, I lay out two different kinds. One is the metaphor of a slide rule, which I'm old enough to remember, which is like, you know, you want to do a mathematical calculation. It just helps you. It doesn't do it for you. It just makes you faster. You know, the other one, which I think is the most profound and gets the least attention, is the idea of a crane. So why is a crane a powerful piece of technology? One of the reasons is there is no amount of human effort that can replicate what a crane can do with a person. So you could have infinite people trying hard without a machine, and they're not going to be able to lift a steel beam seven stories into the air. And so a crane not only accelerates what a person otherwise would do, but it enables powers that people alone do not have. And I would like to see with AI that we have more cranes and fewer looms. Looms are good too. A loom is a very valuable invention. A slide rule is a very valuable invention. But I think if we focus our imaginative attention on the cranes, we may get much better outcomes.
And have you been able to get business leaders to focus more on cranes than looms?
Yeah, I think there's a natural way in which people are doing it anyway. And I mean, you look at something, you know, one of the reasons why the major large language models, Claude, ChatGPT, et cetera, are so powerful is because they can do a little of column A, a little of column B, a little of column C. They're sort of part loom, part slide rule, part crane. And you have technologies that are kind of almost purely a loom. So like a self-driving car is a loom, kind of period, full stop. And then you have stuff that's a crane, and I'll give examples. And so, yes, I do think we're seeing more and more of it. You know, one we're familiar with because we invested in it is a company called Airspace Intelligence. Airspace optimizes aircraft flight routes. They take a plane trying to get from point A to point B, take into account weather conditions and all kinds of stuff, and they tell you what's the fastest and most fuel efficient route. No, a human being given infinite time cannot do that calculation and figure that out. And so that's one example. We'll see, you know, in robotics, we'll see plenty of other examples. And, you know, in a way, it's a call to business leaders, but in a way, really, I think that the attention here is more on the creators. So that's academic research, startup founders. Yes, there are going to be some people inside of companies who do this stuff, but for the most part, you know, I think it's going to happen outside of the big companies.
There's one more finding from our Trust at Work study I want to ask you about. We find that associates and executives are divided based on economic optimism. Executives are much more likely to think that their families will be better off in 5 years, which also leads them to be more trusting of institutions. And just to be clear, the gap between executives and associates around economic optimism is higher than the gap between rich and poor and economic optimism. So it really has to do very much with job level. Why do you think there is a strong connection between economic optimism and trust?
I'll go back to the exact same thing as before, which is power. If you feel like you have agency over where something will go, it's a lot easier to be confident in it. Whereas if you feel like you're sitting in the back seat and somebody else is driving the car, it's a lot scarier. And so I think that to me is the core reason for the confidence difference, which I thought was a fascinating finding. But I don't know. I'm not sure if that's why it is, but that's my simple way of looking at it.
In closing, can you give a tip to the business leaders who are listening to this podcast on a way that you can give power to your employee base?
I think the right question to me is, each workplace is different, each business is different. What form of power might they want? And they may not yet be fully able to express that because people just haven't thought that way, but that's where the exploration starts. And so what's right for a retail business and what's right for a small tech startup is going to be wildly different. But I'll give you some examples of things that I think can be powerful. One is choice over tools. For an office-based company, we invested in a firm called Replit that provides programming assistance. If people want to write their own software, Replit is the kind of tool that can allow people to do that. Or experimenting with whatever other tools they want. Okay, we know we want you to use Zoom, but actually you think this other tool is better. Can you figure out some environment for experimentation? Some of it may be over the things that most affect them. So at the New York Times, the labor union decides healthcare benefits. They don't decide the level of reimbursement. That's negotiated, meaning like the premium contribution from the employer. But as a CEO, I would have loved that. I didn't want to figure out what form of health insurance my own employees should have. I would love for them to figure it out for themselves. I just wanted them to be happy and healthy and manage the cost in a responsible way. And then, as I've said, in some companies, it may be board decisions, you know, what they call in Europe, co-determination. And so it really varies. And there's a menu of options. And I just invite people, reach out. I'm easy to find. Because one of the things we love doing with business leaders is figuring out what is the right path for them to share power with their employees.
Roy, that's a great note to end on. It's always such a pleasure to chat with you. And to our listeners, thank you for listening to The Trustmakers.
Thank you for tuning into The Trustmakers, an Edelman podcast in partnership with Advertising Week, where we speak with leaders and other trust builders across institutions. See you next time.